Hi, and welcome to Guideposts. I'm your volunteer reader, Sandy Summers. Today, we will continue reading the December-January 2025 issue of Guideposts with articles like A Deeper Truth. People Helping People, Everyday Greatness, Charlie Jeffers. Bringing Joy to Kids in Need, One Lego Set at a Time, by Diane Stark, Contributing Editor. Who he is? Charlie Jeffers, 18, founded Pass the Bricks, a nonprofit organization in Marin County, California, to give more kids access to Lego building bricks. Charlie started playing with Lego sets when he was 4 years old, and he credits the toys with helping him learn to be creative and persistent. During 2020, he was home building with them when it struck him that many kids don't get to play with name brand toys because of their cost. He wondered, what happens to Lego bricks that are outgrown or no longer wanted? He hated to think that they ended up in storage units or worse, landfills. He decided to do something to address both problems. What he does. Charlie puts up flyers around his neighborhood asking people to donate their unwanted Lego bricks. He sanitized the bricks, then sorted them by color and size. Because most of the donations were loose bricks and not in complete sets, he used them to develop new sets. He'd choose a Lego minifigure, often with a fun theme such as Star Wars or Marvel, and design a new set around it, such as Iron Man Goes to the Car Wash, Droid Dance Competition, or Making a Wreath Together. Each box set included building instructions and a picture of what the finished creation would look like. Charlie delivered the sets to a local Boys and Girls Club. The kids were thrilled to receive them. He began making regular deliveries to the club, especially around the holidays, because he wanted to make sure that every child would receive something special. Why he does it. Each Christmas and birthday, Charlie would receive brand new Lego sets, but he knew not every child was as fortunate as he was. Lego brings me a lot of joy, and I want to spread that joy to other kids, he says. A Marin County newspaper ran a story about what he was doing. Word spread quickly after that, and soon I had more donated bricks than I could handle on my own, he recalls. Charlie recruited some volunteers, and through social media and word of mouth, the project expanded across the Bay Area. Then people in other states began reaching out to Charlie, asking him how they too could get involved. Pass the Bricks was born. How he does it. Because mailing bricks to other states can be pricey, Charlie developed a network of helpers. His ambassadors do what Charlie does, but in their own communities. They collect and clean used Lego bricks, package them into new sets, and give them to kids who need them. Many of the ambassadors are actually groups of people, families, schools, or church organizations who work together. Ambassadors can be really creative with it and donate their sets wherever they'd like to, Charlie says. Recipients have included children receiving cancer treatment in San Francisco, a boy in Alabama who was shot while playing outside his house, and school kids in Micronesia. Pass the Bricks currently has ambassadors in 150 cities around the world, and more are always welcome. Pass the Bricks has donated more than 13,000 sets to kids in need and collected nearly 7,000 pounds of used Lego bricks, repurposing these terrific toys while keeping all that plastic out of landfills. How you can do it. To donate used Lego bricks or to help clean and sort them, find the ambassador closest to you from the list on passthebricks.org. If there's no ambassador in your area, why not sign up to become one? It would be a fun, rewarding project to take on with a Lego-loving child or grandchild. New Beginnings, A Deeper Truth. A Former NFL Linebacker's Journey from Gridiron to Grace, by George Kuntz, Fond du Lac, Wisconsin. For 9 glorious years, I played football in the NFL. I was a starting linebacker for the Green Bay Packers and the Seattle Seahawks. I was with the Packers when they played in back-to-back Super Bowls. I grew up poor in rural North Carolina. Watching NFL broadcasts, I dreamed that someday I'd be the one playing in those packed stadiums. Later, I felt a thrill each time I ran out of the tunnel onto the field. I loved being able to support my parents financially. I even loved filling out paperwork because I got to list my occupation, professional football player. Retirement comes early for professional athletes. Battered by years of injury, I had no choice but to bow out at age 32. I used to describe being a linebacker as throwing myself into a nightly series of car crashes. The job required toughness. Still, I was unprepared for the massive hit that my spirit took after I was forced to leave the game. All of a sudden, my childhood dream was over. The big paychecks ended too. My profession on paperwork changed to unemployed. I couldn't bear to write down retired, not at 32. I might never have recovered from the loss of my identity had it not been for my wife, Tunisia. She stood by me as I flailed through those first few months of retirement. After I crashed my car following a night of heavy drinking, she calmly asked me, "Are you done?" She helped me find my way back to God. God helped me find a new purpose as a college administrator in Wisconsin. Together, Tunisia and I thought about raising a family in our adopted state. It was a God story, a story of redemption with a perfect happy ending. I loved telling that story in church and at speaking engagements. 7 years after Tunisia and I wed, I discovered that not all God stories are so neat and tidy. In 2009, Tunisia died after a valiant battle with breast cancer. You might think I'd learned to trust God during those rocky months after retirement. That's what I'd thought anyway. Turns out what I'd learned to trust were happy endings. I was devastated by losing Tunisia. I couldn't understand how God could mess up his own story by allowing something so awful to happen to a woman he loved, someone I loved too. I plunged into grief and couldn't find my way out. I became incapable of taking care of my kids and instead sent them to live with their grandparents in North Carolina. I moved into a condo and rattled around my empty life for nearly a year. That's a long time to go without talking to God. The only direction my thoughts seemed to take was me deeper into despair. One afternoon, I found myself lying on my bed thinking about ending my life. I had become a drag on everyone in my family. Surely they would be better off without me. Just then my phone rang. "Smitty," a familiar upbeat voice exclaimed. It was my pastor, Bishop Sedgwick McDaniels at Holy Redeemer Church of God in Christ. Smitty was his nickname for me. "You at home?" he asked. "Yes," I managed to say. I realized I'd been crying. I wiped my eyes. "Come downstairs," Bishop Daniels said. "I'm outside your building. I'm driving to Chicago this afternoon. I want you to join me. God told me you could use some company." Even in the depths of depression, I knew better than to disobey my pastor. I straightened up, went downstairs, and got in the car with Bishop Daniels. It was a 2-hour ride, followed by lunch and a 2-hour ride back. Why Chicago? I think it was because Bishop Daniels somehow intuited that it would take that long to figure out what was wrong with me. My church attendance had been spotty since Tunisia's death. Regardless, Bishop Daniels seemed to understand where my despairing thoughts had taken me. His eyes, filled with compassion and authority, locked onto mine. "George, you are God's faithful servant," he said. "Your life is not yours to take. Jesus is the one who paid the price for your life. He saved you for a purpose. For I know the plans I have for you, plans to prosper you and not harm you. God has a lot of work left for you to do, Smitty. You've been hiding long enough. It's time to pick yourself up and get busy." On the drive back, Bishop Daniels told me he needed an occasional assistant to travel with him to speaking engagements and help with his luggage and medication. He could have hired anyone to do that. He offered it to me because he knew it was what I needed. I grabbed hold of that lifeline. Every 6 weeks, Bishop Daniels and I would travel all over the country. That little bit of purpose helped me gradually reconnect with the rest of my life. I returned to work and remembered how much I loved serving at a university. I felt ready to take care of the kids again. By that point, they had settled into life in North Carolina, and I realized they were better off there until what? There was no obvious reason I couldn't bring them back to Wisconsin. I was as busy as ever, maybe busier because I decided to pursue a PhD in sociology and sports management on top of my job. I was back to my old purpose. I should have been getting back to happy ending, yet something felt missing. I was lonely. I wondered whether I'd ever marry again, but it was deeper than that. I sensed that God was trying to tell me something. I just didn't know what. For years after Tunisia died, I had to stay in Wisconsin for Thanksgiving because of work commitments. The kids were disappointed. Again, Bishop Daniels came to the rescue, inviting me to have Thanksgiving dinner with his family. My friends Eric and Faith also invited me to their house. I split the difference, RSVPing for dinner with the Daniels and dessert with Eric and Faith. Bishop Daniels' family served a very satisfying Thanksgiving dinner. I had no room for dessert, but I couldn't cancel on Eric and Faith. Said goodbye to the Daniels and drove to Eric and Faith's house. I hadn't even gotten out of my car before Faith waved me in. Removing my snow-covered boots in the foyer, I was startled by two little girls dashing past me in frilly holiday dresses. Hot on their heels came a woman about my age. "Girls," she said in commanding voice. The girls came to halt. "This is not how you enter a house, and it certainly is not how you introduce yourself to a stranger. Come back here and say a proper hello." The little girls returned to the door and gave me a bashful hello. "I'm Gina," the woman said to me. "Nice to meet you." The girls scampered off, the woman following them. I returned to my hostess and asked, "Who is that?" "That's my sister Gina," Faith said with a knowing smile. Believe it or not, those girls are her granddaughters. She had a brief marriage out of high school. She's been single for a long time. I think she's exactly your age, George. I felt a spark of curiosity about this woman, who seemed to radiate such confidence and warmth. I had to remind myself that I hadn't come to Eric and Faith's in search of a wife. In fact, I wasn't sure what I was ready for at that point. And yet, watching Gina lead those two adorable granddaughters into the house, I distinctly heard a voice say, "She's the one." Those words simultaneously alarmed and intrigued me. Gina and I kept bumping into each other all evening. I could have sworn some higher power was engineering our encounters. Before I left, I exchanged contact information with her. It was a meet cute for sure. I know what you're thinking. Here comes happy ending number two. It certainly felt like that as Gina and I dated and found ourselves falling in love. As I have discovered, God was up to a lot more than that. For starters, Gina was the first woman I'd ever dated who had no idea I'd been a professional football player. She knew nothing about the sport and she'd never heard of me before. On our first date at a pizzeria, I watched her grow increasingly uncomfortable as people came up and to say hello. I couldn't understand why she was so bothered. "Who are all these people?" she asked at last. "Fans, I guess," I said with a shrug. "Fans of what?" Gina asked. I told her about my pro football days. She nodded, not seeming particularly impressed. She was far more interested in my university work. She was a healthcare provider. It hit me that for the first time in my life, I was talking to someone who saw me as more than a man who had found renewed purpose after football. Gina was a woman of deep faith. For her, there was only one purpose, trusting and following God wherever he may lead. It was a new way of seeing for me. Always before, I'd look for God in happy endings. If the ending wasn't happy, then God must not be in it. That's why I despaired after leaving the NFL and losing Tunisia. At last, I came to understand a deeper truth. Happy endings come and go. That doesn't mean God is absent. It just means you need to learn to see him wherever you are. If you keep your eyes on him, you will find that everything else changes too. After Gina and I married in 2014, the kids returned to live with us. I co-authored a book about transitioning out of the NFL and began serving on the boards of several local organizations. My purpose now is far less glamorous than my childhood NFL dreams, but it's more meaningful than I could ever have imagined. I am a husband, a father, a university administrator, and a man who enjoys giving back to his community. The larger purpose in all of that is God. Now I put my faith in him, not in happy endings. With God, every ending is just a fresh start that draws me ever closer to him. For more on this story, see Family Room. My name is Sandy Summers, and you're listening to Guideposts on Sun Sounds of Arizona, a 24-hour reading and information service for people who can't read print due to a disability. If you missed any part of this program, you may access it anytime on demand at www.sunsounds.org. In addition to the bi-monthly Guidepost magazine, each week we may be reading some of Guidepost's other daily devotions or inspiring stories from Guideposts online. Spiritual Notebook, All Our Needs. Santa's on His Way? Not for Our Family, by Pauline Smith, Albuquerque, New Mexico. Yet another cheery holiday tune was playing over the radio at the thrift store. I cringe. Santa's on His Way? By George Strait. Christmas is always my favorite time of year. Not mine. Not now. I gripped the red plastic handle of my empty shopping basket in one hand and my gift list in the other and stared at the cracked snow globes and chipped mugs among the other cast-offs cluttering the shelves. What did I expect to find? This wasn't Toys R Us. It wasn't even Walmart. This was my last resort. God, I had prayed on the drive here. Give us only what we need. That's all I asked for Christmas. December 23rd, and I still didn't have a single present to put under the tree for my 7-year-old son, Joseph. How was I ever going to find, let alone afford, the brand new craft set he and his friends were going crazy over? When I dropped him off at school one morning, Joe had pointed out the beaded thingamabobs his friends had designed and melted together with the kit. I'd put it at the top of his list. I know Santa will get it for me, he told me. I've been a good boy all year. How could I explain that sometimes even good boys didn't get what they asked for from Santa? My husband Jerry, an auto mechanic, had gone on temporary disability leave months earlier, so I had become our family's breadwinner. It couldn't have come at a worse time. I worked as an IT technician at a software development company, but my boss had cut back my hours. I scraped and saved every penny, but I had enough only for a few secondhand gifts. I hoped that I could at least find my son a new backpack for school, maybe a wooden chess set so he and his dad could play together, and a nice picture frame for my parents, one that would hold Joe's new first grade pictures. But the sorry state of everything in this thrift store dimmed my hopes. Clearly, I had a lot to learn about bargain hunting. Santa's on his way. Yeah, right. Maybe for you, George Strait. I took a deep breath and walked down another aisle. There was a doll that looked like it had been run over by a truck, a set of colored pencils, half of them worn down to tiny nubs. More junk. I found a bunch of frames, but none that would fit Joe's school photos. I stopped at a display of board games and stared at a beat-up box of Monopoly, leaking play money. Lord, if only those beige hundreds were real. I felt plain worn out. It was hard to have faith when things would turn out around us, even if deep down I knew that without hope and faith, I have nothing. Just then I noticed something poking out from behind the box. I slid Monopoly to the side. A wooden chess set? It was in mint condition, never even opened. What a find, I thought. Odd that it would be hiding there. I dropped it in my basket. In the next aisle, I spotted a backpack. It was bright green, Joe's favorite color. Behind it was an action figure in its original packaging from one of Joe's favorite animated shows and a brand new computer game for $3. I swapped out my basket for a shopping cart. This was better than Toys R Us. Maybe I just hadn't been looking hard enough. Looking with hopeful eyes. I returned to the place where I'd seen the colored pencils. Sure enough, on the bottom shelf, I spied an unopened box with beads on the cover, the brand name craft supply set Joe had asked for at only half the original retail price. I grabbed it and practically ran to the checkout. I stopped at two more thrift stores and checked off just about everything on my list. At the last shop, something on the table by the register caught my attention. It was a picture album lying face down. Someone had decided not to get it and dropped it there. I guessed. I opened it up. The slots inside were just the right size for Joe's school photos, and the pages were decorated with fruit, blossoms, and bumblebees. Perfect for my mom, a dedicated gardener. I turned the album over. Inscribed on the front cover was a Bible verse from Philippians. God shall provide all your needs. Caregivers, my not-so-blue Christmas. The frankincense trees were a jumble of dried-up trunks and crumbling branches. They looked as burnt out as I felt. By Lynn Hartke, Chandler, Arizona. I trudged up the steep, rugged slope of South Mountain in Phoenix, my eyes following my husband Kevin's dusty hiking boots. I'd hiked this trail plenty of times, but now it felt like a slog. We had come here to find elephant trees, a member of the frankincense family that's native to the Sonoran Desert. Known as Buceria microphylla, the stumpy trees are easily identified by their thick trunks, which store water during times of drought. We plan to collect small branches and the resin, a golden red sap, as decoration for a blue Christmas service at our church. A special service for those needing comfort during the holiday season had seemed like a great idea when I proposed it at a church staff meeting several months earlier. In my own past seasons of grief, miscarriages early in our marriage, death of friends, and loss of my parents. I could have used such a service. I wanted to champion Blue Christmas for our congregation and community. Champion was the last word I would choose to describe myself at the moment. All fall, I'd been consumed with planning a big event for a cancer nonprofit. I expected to be tired, but I was unprepared for the exhaustion I experienced, a physical, emotional, and spiritual toll I couldn't seem to bounce back from. We passed shriveled brown shells of barrel cactuses along the trail. "Have you ever seen the desert so barren?" Kevin asked. I shook my head. Then I noticed something in the distance. "Look at that," I exclaimed. A saguaro, a gentle giant more than 100 years old, lay toppled on the mountainside. The Sonoran Desert was the driest we'd experienced in 3 decades we'd lived here. In July, we had more than 30 consecutive days of temperatures 110 or hotter, followed by very little of the desert's annual rains in August. We were still seeing the aftermath of that unrelenting heat, an inevitable consequence of climate change. 100 yards further, I spied the remains of what once had been a cluster of elephant trees, now nothing but a jumble of dried-up trunks and crumbling branches. They looked as burnt out as I felt. "This is hopeless," I thought, but Kevin kept going, so I followed. "I'm having second thoughts about my involvement in the Blue Christmas service," I confessed. Kevin slowed down and peered at me over his shoulder. "Didn't you read 2 books on organizing a Blue Christmas service?" he said. "And didn't you talk to 2 pastors who had done them in the past?"
"Yes, but..."
"And you asked our friends who work in hospice to oversee one of the interactive stations? They're trained in grief counseling should the need arise, right?"
"Yes, but you've done everything you can to prepare. What's the real issue?"
Kevin didn't wait for an answer, picking up the pace again, but the question echoed in my mind. I was prepared on a practical and logistical level. Research complete, service planned, volunteers ready. Check, check, check. But inside, I wasn't ready. A cancer survivor, I'd volunteered for years in the cancer community. I'd borne witness to so many people's stories, but now, no more. I wanted to cross my arms over my chest and warn, "Step back, keep a safe distance." Had I tried to give more than I had to give? "There's a healthy one," Kevin said, pointing to a short tree with its telltale thick trunk like an elephant's leg and white peeling bark. Tiny green leaflets like miniature ferns sprouted all along its branches. As I brushed my fingers against the leaves, the scent of frankincense, a combination of orange peels and pine needles, suffused the air. This gift the Magi had brought to baby Jesus, a resin that people had found healing for thousands of years. But there was no resin here. We made do by collecting a handful of small twigs. "Do you remember what Doris said?" I asked. Doris was an elderly friend of ours. Every time she sensed the presence of God, she smelled a pleasing fragrance. "I was thinking of her too," Cohen said. She loved to quote 2 Corinthians 2:15, "For we are to God the pleasing aroma of Christ." Several nights later, we welcomed people to the Blue Christmas service, parents who had lost children, a lady who just moved to the area, a grieving grandmother, a young woman with an aging father who wasn't adjusting well to life without his wife. What could I offer in this space of loss and grief? In the dried up places of my soul, did I even have anything left to give? "Remember the aroma of Christ," Kevin whispered to me, squeezing my shoulder. I turned to look at the frankincense branches on the table. Despite a year of intense drought, some trees had sprouted tiny green leaves. They had found a way to grow in a hard place. We had planned the service to remind people they were not alone, that joy was in reach, to reintroduce them to Jesus who came at Christmas as Emmanuel, God with us in our pain, with us in our loss, with us in our exhaustion. I'd forgotten that as I tried to protect myself by stepping back and keeping a distance from other people. Jesus was inviting me to step closer and stay longer in community. At the back of the sanctuary, a woman stood alone, hesitant. She had recently lost a family member, she told us. She looked as if she wanted to bolt out the door. I went to her, reached out, and touched her shoulder. She turned and clung to me. We swayed. 2 women who both needed to be reminded that we were not alone. I caught the whiff of a fragrance and inhaled deeply. Was it the frankincense from the branches on the table?
Perhaps all I know is that in that moment, I experienced the aroma of Christ. A service for people hurting during the holidays. Blue Christmas services are a modern addition to church's holiday offerings. It's thought that they were the first held as part of a hospice program sometime in the 80s. But in the 1990s, they had become more common across nearly all denominations. A Blue Christmas service provides a place of respite for those who find the season difficult due to sorrow or loss. People might be hurting because of the death of a loved one, a broken relationship, lost dreams, loneliness, chronic pain, or fragile faith. Traditionally, the service is held on the longest night of the year, December 21st, but it can be held anytime during Advent. In researching Blue Christmas and talking to ministers, I learned there's no one set way for a service to be held. Put the emphasis on being supportive, encouraging, contemplation, and providing opportunities for connection. For our Blue Christmas service, we began in the sanctuary, seated together. We opened with prayer, followed by scripture reading. Volunteers lit candles representing different types of loss and grief. Participants were then invited to visit four reflection stations around the room at their own pace. Our artistic creative outlets for people included a station for personal prayer and/or communion with pastor. Our frankincense branches decorated this table. The station where participants could write letters to God expressing their feelings. A station where participants could write about their reasons, big and small, to be thankful, or memories of the person they had lost. These thoughts could then be wrapped in boxes to take home. A station with water, ashes, and smooth stones, directed by a facilitator. Participants talked about their loss as they rubbed ashes representing grief on the stones. Together, they washed the ash off in a basin of clean water, noting that although the ash was difficult to remove completely, sharing their pain helped release more of the ash into the water. We ended the service as we'd begun, in prayer together, in the center of the room. Lynn Harkey. That's all the time we have today for Guideposts. Thank you for listening. My name is Sandy Summers. Stay tuned for more great programming on Sun Sounds.